All right, let's have an AA meeting. My name is Julie, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi,
welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NAVA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, I think that's the edit.
Is that the edit?
I think so. Desperately in need, we'll hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. So tonight, I get the pleasure of introducing our speaker. I've heard his story before, and it is exactly like I thought it would be. This man has very solid sobriety, a great sense of humor, and a very good sense of his self. And it comes off when he tells his story, and I appreciate everything he says when I hear him speak in the room. So with that, I give you Jack.
Thanks. My name's Jack. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Everybody. So, well, first of all, thanks to both, I guess we're celebrating Tinsley and Tim's anniversary tonight, which I'm grateful to be part of. They're both great examples of people who truly give of themselves to both sustain their own recovery, but also to help all of our recovery. So it's great to be here, and a true honor to be doing this on their anniversary. I want to also thank, I'm a proud member and happy member and fortunate member of the 130 Think It Through Sober group here at NAVA, and I see a lot of happy faces in the audience that I recognize. And I want to thank you all for coming out and everybody else for coming out. I think the group members just decided that they'd only have to listen to me a little longer than usual, so wouldn't be too bad. So, my name is Jack. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 12th, 1986. So I've been sober a lot longer than I drank. And my sobriety is certainly the defining part of who I am today. And I believe that, you know, alcoholism or being an alcoholic is central to what I'm, you know, who I am. And I hated being an alcoholic. I did not want to be an alcoholic. I mean, who wants to, you know, first of all, I might have to stop drinking. Secondly, the stigma that came with that, the shame, I fought that, you know, as desperately as I could. But I've come to realize that, you know, I'm glad to be an alcoholic. I'm glad to know what's wrong with me, you know. And I'm really glad to have found a place where I can deal with what's wrong with me and what's fundamental to my character. So, grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I like this. Well, first of all, I made some notes, you know, and I made some diligence. I've done this a few times over the years. I think I spoke here maybe 8 years ago and spoke over in Decatur a couple years ago. So I have some notes. So I looked at my notes and I thought, well, I'm going to freshen this up a bit, and made some diligent notes, and walked out with the old ones. So much for freshening up. But I like to think of myself as, you know, a garden variety drunk who got so sick of himself for long enough that I would willing to surrender for just a minute in order to get some help. And I was fortunate to be swept up in this thing called AA. I'm a Irish Catholic, the oldest of five kids from a middle-class family. You know, we lived, you know, an ordinary, you know, a nice little middle-class existence, went to Catholic school, got driven from the church because of that, and My father was, you know, sort of, you know, my parents were both loving people, and I have to say I grew up, you know, fine. But my dad was not the great Santini, but he was sort of played in his league, you know. And he was a perfectionist. He would say things like, you know, press down on your fork when you're cutting your meat, you know. Why do you come down the stairs so loudly? You know, no elbows on the table. So we kind of walked around eggshells in our house. And I, you know, sort of have developed what I like to call perfectionistic fear. You know, I was always, you know, trying to do the right thing. I was wound tight. And so when I found alcohol, that is an excellent remedy for being wound too tight, you know, because, you know, I was a, you know, being a perfectionist helped me to succeed in school. I was a star sort of student, and I was the president of the class and all of this stuff. But when I found alcohol, that's what I'd been missing in life. And so we had a show. I went to Catholic school, all boys school. So one of the ways to meet girls was to be in the stage productions that they put on. And I was in one of those shows. And we went and we had a party after one of those shows when I was about 16. And it was the first time I ever drank. And I mean, I'd had beers and stuff, little sips of beers from the relatives and stuff, because everybody in my family drank. Everybody. Both sides. And so the first time I had that drink, I was free. I think I had 3.5 beers, maybe 4, maybe all the way to the 4th one, and the world changed for me. I felt free. I felt funny. Girls were funny. The girls were approachable. I wasn't worried about what I was going to say. Everybody was enjoying themselves, and I thought to myself, you know, later, that I'm not doing anything anymore without alcohol. And so every time from that point on, if I was going out, we were getting beer. We were going to the movies, we were getting beer, going to the football game, getting beer, just hanging out, getting beer. Wherever we were going, we were getting beer as much as I could possibly do it. And but I was constrained a little bit because, you know, I was still in high school. I was still sort of behaving to a certain extent, and but things with my father were getting worse. I was applying to college. I was applying to all these tier one schools, you might say, and I think he was terrified at how much it would cost. So I'm sort of getting accepted to Yale, and he's screaming at me about it, you know. And it was like, well, you know, none of it made any sense to me anymore. It was like, this is crazy. So I eventually got a scholarship to Northwestern University, and I went off to school. And once I got there, I was free. And once I got there, I never stopped drinking. I drank every day. I drank every day, I mean, unless I was sick. You know, I mean, so 5 days out of the year, I drank every day from then on. And I always tried to get my fill, you know. I mean, I didn't always go out to get, you know, I would go out to have maybe 5, 6, 7 drinks. Or maybe it was 15, 16, 17. Or maybe it was 25, 26, 27. But whatever it was my fill. And so I didn't always get in trouble when I drank, but increasingly, as time went on, I got in more and more trouble. So I started experiencing the consequences of this disease. First, I got kicked out of school for not showing up to my finals. So then I worked on the railroad for a year, came back to school, got kicked out again for not going to my finals. And so I ended up being about, I had almost 3.5 years in school, but they weren't letting me out or graduate. And I ended up having to get that degree much later. after I got sober. But so I got kicked out of school. Then one day, and then I, and so that started the chain of events where I was always a financial disaster. I was always borrowing money from people. Because I got kicked out of school, they canceled my scholarship. So I was borrowing money to pay tuition. Then always with the ideas, well, I'll finish college, I'll get a job, and then I'll pay everybody back. But I never finished school, never got a job that was worth that paid anything, and never paid anyone back, you know. So my uncle was telling my father that I was a con man, and basically I was burning every bridge that I could burn. I eventually burned every bridge with my brothers, my sisters, my uncles, my parents, of course, all my friends, because I'd show up and, you know, didn't have a place to live. I wanted to sleep on their floor because I'd been evicted. Came home one day and all my stuff had been tossed from a third floor window. And I was just getting started. So eventually, after burning all those bridges, I moved to, I had this old big blue suitcase. It was about this big. Plastic or vinyl or something, and I had packed all my clothes in it and hitchhiked to Florida because somebody had made the mistake of saying you should come down sometime. And so I hitchhiked to Florida and ended up on their doorstep, and they're like, who invited this guy? And so I ended up there, and I got a job, and all my jobs were sort of alcohol related. You know, I started off, in college I was the social chairman of the dorm, you know, because I had a key to the liquor cabinet. And when I got down to Florida, I became the assistant manager of a liquor store. And my boss was an alcoholic, so we got along famously. And I always made it to work because it was the place to be. I could go straight in the door, show up to work, and head into the cooler. And I eventually became the manager of the liquor store, and then I became a liquor salesman. And all of those jobs were great for a guy like me, because I had access to the stash. Before that, I had been a pizza cook and a short order cook, always near the tap. You know, the reason I flunked out of college was because I was working 40 hours a week and then drinking another 40 hours a week. So there wasn't much going on other than that. But I needed to have access to my source. So that all went along well until I, you know, but I mean, my life was increasingly unmanageable. I mean, I had this car that, it was an old 65 Buick Electra 225. It's a big bomber, and the radiator leaked, and it had no taillights. So I, rather than getting him fixed, I never had time in my day. I mean, I would go to work at like noon, work till like 9 o'clock at night, drink from 9 till 3 a.m., sleep. And then I had no time but to rush to work to start again. So I would fill up these big jugs of water, and I'd put them in my back seat, and I would, you know, ride around filling up my car with, you know, jugs of water. That's how I lived. And I would ride the brake of my car to make it look like I had taillights. And that worked for a while until it didn't work, and then I spent the night in jail. And I spent quite a few nights in jail, but I never got a DUI. Back then, they were nicer. You know, I went to jail for my taillights. I went to jail several times for, you know, just passed out behind the wheel, you know. And I was a passer out. I wasn't so much a blackout drunk as a pass out drunk. I went to jail because I fell asleep in a restaurant booth one time having breakfast after one of my nights out and woke up to have the police carting me out sideways. And uh, so But in that one, I did get charged. I got charged, but I managed to get out of that eventually with a nolo contendere. But so from a legal standpoint, it wasn't that bad. But I did go to jail on a semi-regular basis, about once a year. Once every other year, maybe twice a year toward the end. So my car was unmanageable. My financial life was unmanageable. I still barely paid my bills because, even though I worked in where I had access to liquor, I would leave work, drink for a while, and then I'd go on the bar circuit. And I would spend a lot of my money. So I was always, just barely on the edge of financial ruin. And one year I had a tax return, and I needed the money bad. And I had $300 coming back from the government. And I got my form. I filled it right out. I put it in the envelope and set it next to my bed. And there it sat for lack of a stamp. Because I didn't have time in my busy schedule to get a stamp. And I never filed those taxes. And I needed the money. I mean, this is how my life was going. But I managed to get a better job. Started making more money. Still drunk all the time. Still running around. I drove drunk every day. Every day. I was on the highway drunk. I managed to get married to a woman who was out with me just about every night. And then when we got married, she thought it was time to start living our actual life. And she stopped partying, and I got a better job. Now I was a stockbroker. I was making more money than I'd ever made. But I still was, we were in better financial shape because she was more or less guarding the money. But I was going to an office for the first time every day at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock in the morning instead of noon. And then I was coming, and I was getting off at 3 or 4, and then I was staying out all night. And she was like, this is not what she signed up for. And I was like, well, this is not what I signed up for. So we were, we were constantly at odds. And I was constantly, this was the time when I was really trying to sort of, I have to get control of this thing. I can't keep doing this all the time. And so I was really at the point, by this point, where I was willing to stop drinking. I was trying to stop drinking. And I found out that wasn't happening. I couldn't do it. I'd sit at my desk every day saying, I am not going to drink today. I am not going to drink today. And I'd get in my car, and there was I worked in the Mary Esther, Florida, if anybody knows that down there. There's a Highway 98, and it went from Highway 98 to this street to my office, and on the way home I would get on that highway, and it dead ended into Highway 98. If you turned right, it was a dry county to my house. If you turned left, it was all the bars in Fort Walton Beach, Florida. And in the middle lane, you could do either. You could turn left or you could turn right. And every day I got in the middle lane. I'm going to turn right, I'm going to turn right, I'm going to turn right. No, I turn left. And I always thought, well, that car is making me do it. But I was the one that was making the decision to get in the middle lane, So that was just, I was just powerless over it. I had to turn left. So I was powerless over alcohol. I sort of got to a point of capitulation. It's like, well, there's no way I'm ever going to get free of this stuff, so I'm just going to have to manage my drinking. If that means drinking, in the morning, or, I was already drinking at, 3 in the afternoon. If I meant to drink it at lunch, what difference does it make, And I was drinking all night, usually. And I would sleep in my garage a lot. I'd get home, and I'd start, it was 2 in the morning, I'd be thinking, well, what is my reasoning for being out till 2 in the morning this night? And I'd start to concoct my story, and I'd usually pass out, you know. And I, you know, and in Florida, you know, in a garage, and it's 95, you know, 98 degrees outside. It was like 140 in that car, and I'd wake up, and it was sweating, and it was just like, and it was horrible, you know. And then the nights I made it into bed, and then, you know, I'd get up in the morning, and I'd think, well, first of all, it was 50-50 whether I was going to work on any given day, you know. And if I got up, I'd get up, and I'd brush my teeth, and again, it was 50-50 when I brushed my teeth whether I was going to throw up or not. And I remember, man, I'd brush my teeth and throw up, and I would come up from the toilet and look in the mirror, and that look, I think we all know that look, which was bloodshot, blazing, sick, just, I could not stand myself anymore. I couldn't stand who I was. I couldn't stand how I looked. I couldn't stand how I felt. And I couldn't stand who I'd become, which was, you know, generally a liar, you know. I mean, I was lying all the time. I was certainly lying to my wife all the time about, well, I had a big meeting that night, you know, and I had to, you know, I had to entertain the client. And you know, I only had, you know, 20 clients. or 20 clients that mattered. So that couldn't account for all those nights. So one morning, I could not stop drinking, and one night I slept in the garage one more time, and it was 140 degrees, and I was sweating, and I was like, I can't do this anymore. I give up. Because that's what, I mean, you know, we sort of stay out there, at least I stayed out there, thinking, yeah, I know this is a problem, but I'm smart enough and charming enough and resourceful enough and dodgy enough that I should be able to figure this out some way. You know, I should be able to get a handle on this thing. But I could not, you know. I mean, I came home one night going, let's see, I had a good night. Came straight home. I had five beers, two kamikazes, and two scotches. Now, why can't I just do that every night? You know, that's what I was aspiring to, and I couldn't do that. So I just finally gave up, and I came up the stairs, and I told my wife, "Call the treatment center. That's it. I've had it." You know, such a hot shot, you know. Which she was glad of, because she used to turn the commercials up when they came on, you know. Turn up the volume when the treatment center commercials came on. I kind of shrink down. So I went into treatment, and I was like, oh God, it's a God thing. You know, I did not want it to be a God thing. I didn't know much about AA. I called AA once when I was out there. And I thought it was sort of a rescue society or something. You know, they'd come in with a SWAT team to get you out of the bar and take care of you. And that wasn't what it was. I was like, well, here, call me tomorrow. I said, no, you can call me. And I gave him, my number, and he called. And I was like, ah! I was terrified. So anyway, it's a God thing, and I didn't want it because I thought, you know, I thought I'd be on this corner beating a tambourine and shouting for converts, and that just seemed like the worst. That seemed like the worst thing possible. And I thought, you know, well, I'm a little smarter. I make a little more money than some of these guys that are in here, and I'm just a little better. So I don't need all of this. I mean, I need some of it. Yeah, okay, I'll admit it. I need some of it, but I don't need, you know, I don't need a sponsor. That's like way beyond what I need. Because I was capable. I could read the book, make decisions, what was important. you know, And they needed 90 meetings in 90 days. I needed maybe 24, 25, I thought would be reasonable. And because it was like football season and baseball playoffs, and I had stuff to do. So I tried, you know, I was in AA, stayed sober for about 58 days. And I never took the whiskey out of my house. And to this day, I've still never taken the whiskey out of my house. Maybe it's just I'm a defiant alcoholic. But I believe that it's my problem, not everybody else's problem. So, my wife's family drinks. I mean, they don't drink like we drink, but they drink. So I was always defiant that I was not going to, that I wasn't going to do that. Well, it cost me this time because we had some people coming over, and my wife had put out a bottle of Old Bushmills Irish whiskey, which I loved. But I was on the phone because I'd gotten much smarter. I'd gotten much smarter once I came into AA. I realized now what my condition was. I had a glop of stuff in my brain. When I drank it, it activated it. It makes me want more. And so I now knew, and I was on the phone telling somebody this. I know now that for me, to drink is to die. So I'm good. And it wasn't an hour later, I was pouring that Old Bushmill down my gut, and I brushed my teeth real quick and pretend I didn't do it. And we had people that were coming over, and they were drinking, but I wasn't drinking because everybody knew Jack had just been in treatment. But I learned something very important. You know, I had flipped that switch back on because I did not spend another minute without thinking about drinking. And so I went to an AA meeting two nights later and said, "I don't know what it is, but I really feel like drinking." And they said, "Well, chair the meeting. You'll pick up a lot of good tips." So I chaired the meeting and left and headed straight to the nearest bar. And I went out on one of my worst drunks ever. Me and my wife had a big fight. I was tearing the house up, digging up money because that was it. I'm packing my shit. I'm going to Chicago. And I cashed a bad check. Well, it wasn't bad when I wrote it. It was bad when she closed the checking account the next day. But somehow I think it cleared. But I sort of knew that it wasn't going to be good. Anyway, I cashed a check, and I had a case of whiskey, and about $500, and I was going to Chicago. And I was hammered this particular night. I mean, you know, it's one of those nights where you almost drink yourself sober, you know. I mean, just, I've been drinking really hard for 6-8 hours, and everything was closing, so I was headed to Chicago. So I was in my car with my clothes and my case of whiskey, and I went through this light in Pensacola, Florida. It's on Mobile Highway in Fairfield, and I went through that light, and I had a moment of clarity. It's like I couldn't have been more drunk. I couldn't have been more addled and weirded and crazy, and boom, clear as day, the thought came to me, wherever you go, you're taking you with you. And whatever's going to happen is going to happen here. And I pulled over into this $14 a night motel room and rented this motel for a week and drank my whiskey. So I would drink all day, and then there's a little crappy bar down the street, and I'd walk down there, I'd get something to eat, I'd drink in there for a couple hours, come back, sort of drinking around the clock. And, you know, I was flopping around like Dan Aykroyd in Trading Places, you know. And, but, you know, I mean, I sort of was looking at my new reality, you know. I mean, this, I mean, nobody in Chicago wanted to see me, you know. So I didn't know what I thought was going to happen up there. And no one in Pensacola wanted to see me, really, either. So, and I, you know, felt like, you know, I'd been fired from my job. So, you know, it was just me, bottles of booze in a lousy hotel room. So I spent about 8 days in there, and kind of had about a half a bottle of whiskey left that I gave to the maid, so to speak. Here you go. And I was going back to AA. And I went back to AA that day. And I went to the meeting, and I picked up a white chip. And felt good. And I left the meeting and drove straight to the liquor store. Now, I'd had enough AA, and I'd had enough exposure to a guy who had become my sponsor. And he used to say, try saying, "God, please relieve my alcoholism." And so I said, "God, please relieve my alcoholism. Help me to drink at the next liquor store, not this one." And so I backed up the car and I drove to the next liquor store. I said, "God, please relieve my alcoholism. Help me to not drink at this liquor store. Help me to drink at the next one." And I did that for 3 hours. I visited every liquor store and bar in Pensacola, Florida, not drinking, one liquor store at a time. And about 3 hours in, it passed. And that was the first time it had ever passed. You know, I mean, I always felt, you know, I mean, when you feel that coming on you, that you have to wet this down. You know, there's no escaping it. It's not going to change. It feels like a permanent condition. And this was the first time I had managed to get through that without wetting it down. So I learned that it can pass. And I also learned that if I seek power, I mean, I didn't know this, I wasn't thinking this at that time, but if I appeal to a power greater than myself, just putting it out into the universe maybe gives me just that little edge. You know, I just don't have to drink right now. God, please help me. So that was, you know, sort of my second surrender. And I came back to AA, and I thought to myself, and I was talking to some people, and they were saying, you know, "Jack, you got to do AA's way, not Jack's way," which is what I'd been doing, which was Jack's way was, you know, 20 meetings in 90 days, was sponsoring himself, was deciding that I needed 3 steps, you guys needed 12. And so I kind of got back and I thought, you know, I was going to try AA's way. And I feel like I had that, you know, you have a window of willing. I had a window of willingness, you know, and I feel like we all have that. And we're all fortunate if we grasp onto this thing while we have that window of willingness. Because if I stay in here too long without sort of getting down to business, it passes, you know. But I was, you know, beaten up enough from this 8 days in the motel room that I was really willing. And I got a sponsor, and eventually I got a sponsor, the guy who told me about God, please relieve my alcoholism. And he said, you know, get a notebook, call me every day for 30 days. If you can do that, then we'll get a notebook and we'll get down to business and we'll start doing these steps. And we wrote, what does this step mean to me? How will I use this step in my life on all 12 steps? And he went through those with me. And that is where things really changed for me. And it's the same thing. I do the same thing with the guys I sponsor today. No different. Same speech. You know, call me for 30 days. You know, if you can do that, maybe we'll get busy on the steps. I'm not your banker. I'm not your lawyer. All that. And so, you know, going through the steps, being willing, and for me, I think all of this comes down to willingness in the end, you know. I was willing to make those phone calls, you know. I was willing to do this work, and I don't want to do work, you know. I'm an alcoholic. I want to think about it a little bit and be fixed. But, you know, he got me to, you know, read the literature, the 12 and 12 in the big book, make notes, answer those questions, and we talked about it, talk about how we use these steps, that these steps have utility in my life. They're not just some hocus pocus on the wall, that they're meaningful. You know, sometimes I'm powerless over stuff. Sometimes there's a possibility of solution that I'm not seeing. Sometimes I have to seek power greater than me. Sometimes I have to do an inventory on a situation that, you know, where's, you know, and see what my part in it is. Sometimes I have to make amends. Sometimes I just have to meditate and let the answer come. So all of these things have eventually, you know, proved useful to me, not just in staying sober, but like in business. I had a situation in business where, you know, he drew this thing on there. This is in the second step. And he said the second step is that God could remove my, restore me to sanity. A power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Didn't say instantaneously zap me into sanity. He said it was possible. Maybe. Maybe, if I do some other stuff. But he introduced the idea of the possibility of solution. He drew this pie chart. And he's put A, B, C, and D out here. And those are the things that I'm looking at as possible solutions to any given problem. None of them look good. And this happened to me in my business. We had some projects that were on hold, burning cash, and A, B, C, and D, all those solutions looked bad. You know, some of them were close the company down, some of them were, you know, cut these people, some of them were, you know, try to do something illegal. Anyway, all of them were A. None of them were very good. And we had this little part, and what he said was, A, B, C, and D don't look good, but maybe there's a possibility of solution that I'm not seeing. Because I didn't see AA in my future. I didn't see AA in my life. And that the solution often comes from P, Q, R, S. And that's what happened. We were selling a part for like $100, well, $200. We were making like $100 on it. And we did this as a favor because it was nothing. But one day, while I'm looking at A, B, C, and D, these guys called up and said, we need 500 of those. 500? Okay. So then we need 1,000. Then we need 1,500. Now we need 10,000. And now we need 40,000. I was like, holy shit. And our problems were solved on something that I wasn't even trying to, you know, I didn't see that coming. I didn't see where that was coming from. So that's, you know, sometimes I have to have faith that there's a solution out there that I'm not seeing right now. And AA is one of those things for me that I had to have some faith in. You know, I have to have some faith to move forward in these steps. You know, I didn't know if they were going to work for me, but I was beaten up enough and I had that window of willingness where I was willing to give it a go. And so I, you know, I said, maybe there's a possibility I can get better. And then we got to the third step, and, you know, I didn't, you know, I don't know, I can't, how do I deal with God? You know, I mean, my will and my life, how do I turn it over to the care of God? You know, I need to see God's balance sheet. You know, I need to see some documentation. I need to see what the plan is, what the references. My sponsor said, the less you know about God, the better. You know, that you're not it, and have some faith and move. All you're doing is making a decision to move forward. Because the book says something like, we can't cure a problem of self-will with self-will. And that is what I've been trying to do all those years, is cure a problem of self-will with exerting more self-will on it. And I've found that I couldn't do it. And so God makes that possible. And I didn't like that idea, but, you know, it also says in the book, you know, there is a solution. No one likes it, you know. But it turns out it works. So moving forward in faith on 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, you know, I began to experience some freedom from alcohol. I began to rebuild a little bit of character. And for the life of me, I can't understand how anybody could drink like I drank and not come out having to fix some stuff. Because I was broken. I was, you know, I was a cheat, dishonest. I lied automatically, you know. I didn't immediately think, well, what's the right thing to do here? I thought, what's the best thing for me to get out of whatever problem I'm in? And so... having to look at those things in 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. Make amends. When I started making amends, and I had a long list, especially financial amends, and I owed, you know, several people, several thousand, one person, you know, a lot of money. But I started paying the 25, and then the 50, and then the 100. And I started to walk around with just a little bit, felt a little bit better about myself. I felt like I was on the road to recovery. So the steps, you know, I can't emphasize enough that's where I began to, the obsession to drink began to be lifted for me. When I got right around step 9, it was around 9 months sober. Because before that, you know, I mean, getting sober is a grind. I mean, I fought it every minute of every day for 6 months, easily. I was always thinking about drinking. And today I'm in a position of neutrality. I never think about drinking unless I'm talking to you guys, you know. When I first got sober, I walked down the grocery store aisle. I was like, there was like a magnetic pull to the wine section. And, you know, now I walk down there, it's like it's paper towels or something. It doesn't affect me. So, you know, this thing works if you can just kind of, if you can stay with it long enough. You know, for me, applying the steps to my life has been important. You know, I said, God, please relieve my alcoholism, and somehow my alcoholism has been solved. And I have to say, I have to utilize God in my own life, in my business life, in my people know this story, but I was a salesman. I was selling financial products to the state of Florida's employees and then to educational institutions. Well, the state of Florida I knew very well. An educational product I didn't know very well. And I had an appointment with an educational, with a college in Fort Walton Beach. So I was thinking to myself, God, I don't know this product. They're going to look at me. They're going to ask me questions. They're going to find out I'm an idiot, and they're not going to buy anything. So what I'll do is I'll call up. I'll tell them my car is broken, and I can't get there, but I'll reschedule for another day, and then I'll study up, and then I'll be real smart, and they'll buy from me. Well, I'm sitting there concocting this story in the parking lot, and I said, God, please help me to get out of this car. Please help me to overcome this fear and get out of this car. So I got out of the car and I walked in the building, and they're all like, "Where are the forms? Because it's the last day to sign up, and you're the only guy that's come by." So they didn't ask me anything, and I'm just handing out forms. They're signing up, and you know, and I set the record for sales on that. And I thought, you know, I set the record for sales. And like the chairman of the company called. I was in the newsletter. They asked me to do a course to teach other salespeople how to do this. And all I could think of myself, how many times have I not gotten out of the car? You know? And that's the thing. I mean, I block myself off from stuff. And so that's where I have to sort of reach out, overcome my perfectionistic fear that still to this day haunts me, and ask God for help. And I find that help, you know, in a power greater than me, and in the universe, whatever, you know, I don't know what God looks like. I don't know if it's a guy, you know, guy with a gray beard, or, you know, the sum of all the electrons moving around. I don't know. It's beyond my pay grade to know. What I do know is that I've experienced God in my life. I've experienced a power greater than myself. What I have to do, it says, if I do these 12 steps, I will have a spiritual experience. A spiritual awakening, sorry. And that's happened for me, you know. That's the message, that if I do these steps, I'll have a spiritual awakening sufficient to recover from alcoholism. And now I have to practice these steps in my life. And so I don't have to know, I don't have to debate. I mean, I'm not trying to get into a philosophical thing. I've experienced a power greater than myself in my life. You know, I no longer have to, you know, I'm not interested in the debating society. I'm interested in, I know this has worked for me. So I'll say one more thing. I was 2.5 years sober, and the closest I really came to a drink since I've been sober. I mean, I've had other times when I have, you know, I've been sober long enough where I don't think about a drink a lot, but I think about one every now and then that, you know, reminds me why I keep coming here. You know, I call them shots over the bow. And one time, real quick, I was in this hotel, and I was 10 years sober. I was walking down this hotel hallway, and there right in the hallway was a little bottle, a little miniature of Crown Royal. And I was like in a tractor beam. I was like, there's a little bottle of Crown Royal right in the hallway. I was like zoomed in on it. And I'm like, God, please relieve my alcoholism. God, please relieve my alcoholism. God, please relieve. And I get up, it was a little shampoo thing that had fallen off the cart. I was like, well, okay, that worked. But I had gotten, I was frustrated early. It was 2.5 years in my sobriety. I'd quit smoking. I was agitated. I hated my wife, my dog, my job, my boss, my friends, AA, anybody that was in the road. I had it. And I was traveling, and I was in Panama City, which is about 100 miles from where I lived. And I was in a hotel for 2 nights because I was working that area. And I had made up my mind I was going to drink. Nobody's going to know. I'm just going to do my thing. And I had enough AA in me that I said, okay, well, I'll go to a meeting, and then I'm going to drink. And then I'm going to go to drink. So I went to this meeting, and it was in the middle of nowhere. It was outside Panama City, in like this little old brick building room with like almost a bare floor, little folding chairs, one light bulb hanging down in the middle of the place. And this woman was sharing about Well, they turned the electricity off, but I'm grateful because we still have the water and we can give the baby a bath. And, I mean, she's grateful for that. That just sort of melts all my problems, you know what I mean? And then, out of nowhere, this guy from my home group walks into that meeting. And, you know, you can call that what you want. But I'm like, what in the hell are you doing here? And he happened to be working in the same area. He did traveling sales also. So instead of going out getting drunk, we went out and had coffee afterwards. So is that a miracle? It is for me, you know, because I mean, that's as close as I can. So I like to say, do one more thing, you know. Don't wet it down right now. Do one more thing and allow, you know, miracles to happen. So for me, I'm powerless. I became willing enough to seek your help, and I continue to seek that help, and I'm grateful for your help all these years later. Thank you.
Told you. Thank you for that. I'm so glad you decided to get out of the car and come inside and tell us your story. I have asked Jackie to come up and give out our chips.
I'm Jackie and I'm an alcoholic. Ah, there they are. Okay. All right, we have a chip system. Marks our time in sobriety, not the quality of our sobriety. We have a white chip, International Sign of Surrender. It says you want to stop throwing up and start showing up one day at a time. Anybody? Okay, after 30 days, you have a silver chip. It's not really silver, it's plastic, but hey, who cares? 30 days. No? We got this kind of weird gold. Yeah, I know, 60 days, but it's a very strange color of gold if you want it. 60 days? 90 days, we have a red chip. That means there's now some blood flowing through your alcohol stream. Anybody? No? 6 months, we have the yellow chip. Some people call it sunshine chip. I say there's nothing yellow about being sober 6 months. It's hard as hell. 6 months. Okay, after 9 months, you get a green chip. My old home group used to call this the kudzu chip. Cuts you sober now. It was Douglasville people, okay? All right, and after 365 days and 1,000 nights, you get the coveted blue chip. That means blue skies ahead instead of blue lights behind. Anybody need a blue chip? All right. I do the regular one. No, you do. Cool. All right. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. That's a wonderful story, Jack. Thanks so much. Tim came to this meeting 12 years ago and picked up a white chip. And he can tell you sometime an acquaintance was telling his story that night that he knew from the past. And he introduced him to me, and we've been together ever since then. I hate long presentations of chips, but I don't want to do that. But, you know, if anybody is saying, you know, I think I'm going to have to drink because of this, because of blank, whatever's in that blank, Tim's been through it, and I mean that. I don't think you can put anything in that blank he has not been through it. And I thought about what can I say about Tim, not to make him look good, but to talk about what this program can do for all of us. And I think that night when he came in, Tim saw clearly what the gift we get here, and his commitment, which has never wavered. And I've talked to him every day for 12 years, pretty much. His commitment is not based on what's going on around here. It's on the gift he's got inside. And he reminds me on a constant basis of what an amazing gift this is. And it's not about the outside stuff. It's about what we get on the inside. I am a better man because he's in my life. And it's an honor to give him a 12-year chip.
All right.
Thank you, Tim. I'm Tim R., and I'm an alcoholic. Like Tim said, it's 12 years. And it was April 30th, And so that was last Tuesday, so that's why I didn't do it last Monday night. That day, Pam and Kelly came to visit. She asked me how I was doing, and she thought I was doing okay because I'd been white knuckling it for what she thought was about 18, 19 months. But about 4 months prior to that, I figured I could drink like a gentleman again, and I was wrong. Real wrong. And she goes, "How's it going?" I said, "Not good, not good." She goes, "What's wrong?" She says, "I can't stop drinking." She goes, "Well, I thought you quit drinking two Thanksgivings ago." I said, "I did, but started up around Christmas, and here it was in April." She goes, "Well, it can't be that bad." And I said, "Well, I got 2,000 bottles of red and white table wine that I bought at Whole Foods because it was organic and it's down in the cellar. Things are not real good." So she goes, "I know what we're going to do, pack a bag." And she brought me straight here, and I came to my very first AA meeting. I was 53 years old, and I met Tim. But the guy that was telling his story was my high school girlfriend's little brother, and I was his bootlegger and peddler. They had a little treehouse. He's describing the treehouse. "You wouldn't believe this treehouse when I was growing up. My sister's boyfriend would bring us supplies every Friday, and we'd steal money from our parents. He was getting rich. And I was sitting right there, you know, in the second row with Pam and Kelly, and I finally figured out he's talking about me. I said, "Well, maybe this will be my only chance to pick up a white chip." And so when I picked up my 12-year chip at my other home group up in Gainesville, I was telling about this meeting and telling about the website, aabluechipspeakers.org. And I said, "We've got over 300 speakers where you can download their stories for free. And a lot of them have come from Gainesville, but there's a whole bunch from everywhere." And there's just this. So, and then I picked up another chip a little bit later. Actually, I was telling my story Saturday night. And one of the guys that had been there, I was using my notes, and I'd done a little more research from my notes from a previous story. And at that point, I had counted them, and there were like 400. So I just went with the 400. So within a matter of about 3 days, I've gone from 300 to 400. So they're counting my inventory. They're like, "Oh, well, those 300 of 3 days ago. Now it's 400. Well, I went and counted them again. It's almost 500. So we're up to date. Thank you.
Juliet, I'm an alcoholic, and Tim Moore touched on the word gift, which is the word I was thinking of when I was asked to give Tinsley his chip. The longer you stay in the program, you begin to see the universe reveal its gifts to you, and it revealed Tinsley to me probably, 10 or 11 years ago now, in the 9:30 meeting where we got to know each other, and he is a true gift to my sobriety and to me as a person, and he is now an official old-timer.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. And it was 20 years ago today that Sergeant Pepper taught a band to play. And I've been waiting 12 or 13 years to say that after I heard Jack pick up his 20-year chip and say it in this small room in there. But it gave me a lot of happiness to have you tell your story. And I loved the part about where you said that the car would find its way into the middle lane. And that's exactly the way. I did not get this. Oh, by the way, this is 20 years. So I didn't get 20 years right off the bat. I had 9 years where I was in and out, and I was in that middle lane. I was on the fence,
with this whole thing. And somebody in a meeting one time shared that we don't need to be on the fence with recovery because the disease of alcoholism owns the fence. And the disease of alcoholism evidently owns the middle lane, too. But anyway, I continue to do the stuff that was recommended when I first came in. My first sponsor told me that if I would do five things, I would stand a great chance of staying sober. He said, one, go to a ton of meetings. Two, get a competent sponsor of my own gender. Three, work all 12 steps in order. Four, learn to pray. And five, work with others. And I can tell you that in 20 years, I have never relapsed when I held a service position in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not saying that to brag, but I think it helps really to get involved. So if somebody's new and wanting to try this thing out, I can tell you that this is a great way to enjoy your sobriety. We get sober by not drinking, but we stay sober by enjoying our sobriety. And thanks to this program and the company that I keep and these meetings, I can tell you that I've experienced the miracle of recovery, which is not that I don't drink. The miracle of recovery is that I don't want to drink. So thank you for my sobriety.
Congratulations to our celebrants, and we offer the white chip one more time, just in case you were in a blackout. I know Jack hates it when we do this, but we're going to do it anyway. All right, congratulations on the chip. Alright, we're going to get out of here, you guys.
Miss Kelly and Pam have brought a beautiful cake back there.
Cake. A baby cake. Alright, here we go. If there are no further announcements, I remind each of you that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
the bottom.